And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, March 17th, 2016. I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, anything you might need to take action. Let's start with announcements. The Appalachia Resist Social and Environmental Justice Action Camp is starting tomorrow. They're a small group of rural activists who use direct action as a tactic to resist the fracking of industry in their region. If you want more information, send an email to appalachia.resist@gmail.com. appalachia.resist@gmail.com. Their action camp will be held this weekend. And hopefully you can get some information out of them today. Also, please join a night of music to benefit the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project and support forest defense in eastern Oregon. That benefit show is Friday, March 25th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Velo Cult, located at 1969 Northeast 42nd Avenue in Portland. There is a $10 to $20 suggested donation to this all-ages event. There will also be a raffle to benefit the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. And Karen Coulter, the director of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, will give a presentation on their forest defense work in eastern Oregon. Help Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project fight destructive timber sales on four national forests in eastern Oregon. The funds raised at the benefit will help support this year's field season. Every summer, Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project volunteers field survey thousands of acres of proposed timber sales. The evidence and information they collect is used in comments to the Forest Service and in potential negotiations and litigations. Once again, that benefit, Friday, March 25th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Velo Cult, 1969 Northeast 42nd Avenue in Portland, Oregon. Bring money. And here is the, well, let's have some more announcements. Alameda Creek Volunteer Restoration will be taking place March 19th. They will be meeting at 10 a.m. at the Niles Staging Area parking lot on Old Canyon Road near Canyon Oaks Court in Niles, California. You know, Fremont, roughly 720 Old Canyon Road, and they'll work until about noon. Please dress appropriately for work, and they'll have gloves and tools. Bring an empty container for water. Go to www.alamedacreek.org to RSVP. Once again, that's www.alamedacreek.org. ORG. And the Elliott Rainforest Climbing Camp will take place April 19th through the 24th in Oregon. This announcement found at the Earth First Newswire. They'll have climbing training for a week. They'll only take 20 to 30 participants. If you are a newbie, be prepared to spend the whole week there. Bring food to share. And if you want more information, send an email to elliottclimbcamp2k16@gmail.com. That's elliottclimbcamp2k16@gmail.com. Or go to www.earthfirstjournal.org and check the newswire for that announcement. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. On March 8th and 9th, Yellowstone National Park organized a media tour of their Stevens Creek bison trap, where 150 wild buffalo were being held captive for slaughter and potential quarantine. All of what you saw there was paid for with your tax dollars. Some of the footage was shot by Buffalo Field Campaign's Mike Mies, and some was captured by the Park Service's GoPro cameras. 150 of America's last wild buffalo were run through the gauntlet of Yellowstone's Stevens Creek capture facility. 93 buffalo were shipped to slaughter by the Intertribal Buffalo Council and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, both of which are signatories to the Interagency Bison Management Plan. Another 57 buffalo, all orphaned calves and yearlings, are still being held in the trap. Every person working at the trap is employed by the Yellowstone National Park. The Montana Department of Livestock has Yellowstone trained so well, the department doesn't even have to be present except when escorting buffalo to the slaughterhouses. These acts by Yellowstone National Park are horrific and criminal. There should not even be such a facility inside the world's first national park, much less anywhere else. There is no justification for the Park Service to commit these atrocities, and they justify their actions under the banner of the Interagency Bison Management Plan, and Yellowstone could pull out of that any time. They may face a lawsuit by livestock interests if they did that, but so what? So much new information has come to light, so much change has come from the landscape, and such a groundswell of public support has emerged for wild migratory buffalo that a lawsuit might be hugely beneficial. The callous behavior of Yellowstone Park rangers and biologists who are harming the buffalo reveals the gross disconnect these people have from the sacred beings they are charged with protecting, and how wantonly they are willing to betray not only their mission, but the sacred buffalo for the whole world. The killing of buffalo, whether it's through hunting or slaughter, is part of the agency Bison Management Plan, which was crafted for the benefit of livestock interests in Montana and Wyoming, not for buffalo. Even those hunting under treaty rights are being used by Montana's livestock interests and consequently the IBMP to facilitate the destruction of buffalo and prevent them from restoring themselves in Montana and elsewhere. Whether the excuse for these fatal attacks is brucellosis or population control, neither one is based on reality, and they only serve a political agenda. The IBMP exists because Montana livestock interests sued Yellowstone for allowing wild bison to migrate into Montana, and because of a law crafted by the livestock industry, MCA 81-2-120, which places the Montana Department of Livestock in charge of managing wild bison. One industry's intolerance is driving a national treasure towards the brink of extinction. We know how you care deeply about wild bison, and one of the single most important things you can do is help repeal that law. For further information, go to the webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the lost wild buffalo in the United States. And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has denied the Jordan Cove project. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has denied the Jordan Cove LNG terminal in Coos Bay, Oregon, and its associated Pacific Connector pipeline. This is a huge victory for the Rogue Basin and all of those who would have been impacted by this project. Because the record does not support the finding that public benefits of a Pacific Connector pipeline outweigh the adverse effects on landowners, the FERC denies Pacific Connector's request for a certificate of authority to construct and operate the project, as well as the related blanket construction and transportation certificate applications. This news was brought to us by the Rogue Riverkeeper and Klamath Siskiyou Wild E-News. For more information, go to rogueriverkeeper.org. And in breaking news from the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, for years, compassionate members of PETA have campaigned long and hard to end the cruel confinement of orcas at SeaWorld. Today there is finally a payoff, as SeaWorld has announced that it is ending its orca breeding program immediately. This means that the orcas who have been forcibly bred and confined for years in tanks that are, to them, the size of a bathtub, will be the last ones made to endure a miserable life of deprivation at the parks. SeaWorld has taken a step forward, but more changes must follow. Orcas, dolphins, beluga whales, seals, and many other animals have suffered in confinement at the parks for many decades. To do them right now, SeaWorld must open its tanks and release these long-suffering animals to the ocean sanctuary so that they may have some semblance of a real life outside of the prison tanks. We must keep the pressure on SeaWorld until it empties those tanks and ends the use of all live animals at all of its amusement parks. And for more information, go to www.peta.org. From World Environment News, a Canadian man has been accused of smuggling $2 million worth of narwhal tusks. This story written by Marcus Howard with editing by Sandra Mahler. A former Royal Canadian Mounted Policeman has been accused of smuggling $2 million worth of narwhal tusks into the United States, is now in custody pending his trial on money laundering charges, the U.S. Justice Department said. Authorities accuse Gregory Logan, 58, of St. John, New Brunswick, of having illegally smuggled since 2000 at least 250 narwhal tusks from Canada through Maine. Prosecutors says the profits from U.S. collectors were then used to further the smuggling activity. Native to the Arctic, narwhals are a species of whale and have large protruding tusks. They are protected marine mammals under U.S. and international law, although import permits are sometimes granted. On Friday, Logan was extradited from Canada to the United States and is currently awaiting a May 3rd trial in the U.S. District Court on related money laundering charges. Logan, who retired from the famed Mounted Police in 2003, was initially indicted in November of 2012 on conspiracy, smuggling, and money laundering charges. In December 2013, he was arrested in Canada at the request of the United States and pleaded guilty to related wildlife smuggling, according to authorities. It was unclear why Logan's extradition to the United States took so long. His attorney, Kaylee Foster, did not immediately return messages. This case shows wildlife trafficking can involve millions of illegal transactions, compounding the damage it does to the wealth and diversity of life on our planet, said Assistant Attorney General John Cruden in a statement. Two other men were also indicted in the case. Andrew Zaruskas of Union, New Jersey, was convicted and sentenced to 33 months in jail. Jay Conrad of Lakeland, Tennessee, pleaded guilty and is awaiting sentences. And again from World Environment News, Thomson Reuters, Big Five is off the cards as South Africa has closed its 2016 leopard hunting season. In this story written by Ed Stoddard with editing by Susan Fenton, for the first time in decades, hunters with deep pockets cannot target the so-called Big Five game animals in South Africa because the government has imposed a ban on leopard hunts for the 2016 season. The temporary ban comes in the wake of a global uproar last year over the killing of Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe by a U.S. dentist. The decision, however, was driven by science, not emotion. South African Environment Minister Edna Molewa is a vocal advocate of the hunting industry, which the government estimates contributes 6.2 billion rand, about $410 million annually, to Africa's most advanced economy. Leopard is one of the five game most desired by hunters, along with lion, rhino, buffalo, and elephant. The South African National Biodiversity Institute, a government research organization, recommended the temporary ban because it said leopard numbers could not be firmly established. There is uncertainty about the numbers, and this is not a permanent ban, but we do need more information to guide quotas, said John Donaldson, the director of SANBI's research. Given their secretive and nocturnal nature, leopards are not easy to count. SANBI grew on studies and data from a number of sources, but Donaldson said that most was from protected areas and national parks, not private lands. The Professional Hunters Association of South Africa disagrees, saying the data gives an incomplete picture. There are lots of leopards on private land, said PHASA Chief Executive Taria Owen. She said FASA was providing the government with leopard data from private lands. South Africa has also been scorched by its worst drought on record, and Owen said this was good for leopard numbers as predators typically thrive when rains are poor, leaving much of their prey in a weakened and easy-to-kill state. Unwin said it cost up to $20,000 to shoot a leopard, and several of FASA's members had to refund clients who had put down deposits on leopard hunts. Most of the foreign hunters who came to South Africa for such game are Americans. Hunting of all Big Five has been legal in South Africa since the 1980s, when hunts for white rhino were resumed. And humans have been blamed for the deaths of 13 bald eagles in Maryland. In this story written by John Clark, with editing by Lisa Von Ahn, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. the death of 13 bald eagles in Maryland's largest die-off of the U.S. national bird in 3 decades were caused by humans, officials said on Thursday. Lab results showed the eagles did not die of natural causes, including diseases such as avian influenza, U.S. Bird and Wildlife spokesperson Catherine Hibbard said. The agency declined to say whether the birds were poisoned. Our investigation is now focused on human causes and bringing to justice the persons responsible for the death of these eagles, Hibbard said in their statement. Maryland Natural Resources Police received a call on February 20th reporting 4 dead eagles near the Federalsburg in the eastern part of the state. Officers arrived and discovered 9 more dead birds nearby. The 13 birds represented Maryland's largest bald eagle die-off in 30 years, officials said. The bald eagle, which almost disappeared from the United States decades ago, was removed from the Federal Endangered Species List in 2007 after its habitat protection and the banning of pesticides such as DDT led to its recovery. The federally protected bird is the symbol of the U.S. government and is featured on currency and the presidential seal. The maximum fine for harming a bald eagle is $100,000 each and up to a year in prison, Hibbard said. And Sea Shepherd Australia has reported the following news: a victory against illegal fishing in Antarctica. The last toothfish poaching vessel, the Viking, has been sunk by Indonesian authorities, and Sea Shepherd has concluded Operation Icefish 2015-2016. Authorities in Indonesia have sunk the last of the Bandit 6 toothfish poaching vessels, the Viking, in Pangandaran, West Java. Sea Shepherd representatives were on the ground to film the sinking, which marks the end of over a decade of toothfish poaching in the Southern Ocean at the hands of the Bandit 6 and the conclusion of Sea Shepherd's 12th Southern Ocean Defense Campaign, Operation Icefish 2015-2016. Operation Icefish campaign leader Captain Siddharth Chakravarti said, "In a span of just 15 months, Sea Shepherd has cleaned up the Southern Ocean of illegal fishing, an issue that was largely thought unsolvable under current international legal instruments was confronted and dealt with using 2 direct action at sea campaigns. 6 of the most notorious and persistent poaching vessels on this planet are now out of commission, making this one of the biggest successes in marine conservation history." Sea Shepherd first focused its attention on the illegal operations of the Bandit 6 toothfish vessels in 2014 when it launched Operation Icefish, the organization's first campaign to target illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing in the Southern Oceans. In December of 2014, the Sea Shepherd ships Bob Barker, under the command of Captain Peter Hammerstedt, and San Simon, under the command of Chaplain Chakravarti, departed Australia and New Zealand, respectively, to patrol the Southern Ocean for the Bandit 6. The 6 vessels, outlaws that had exploited loopholes in international law for over 10 years, fishing illegally for vulnerable Antarctic and Patagonian toothfish in the shadowlands of Antarctica, were outside of the reach of traditional law enforcement. That campaign, which lasted over 5 months and saw the historic and world-famous chase of the most notorious of the poaching vessels, Thunder, by the Sea Shepherd ship Bob Barker, spawned international efforts that caused massive disruptions to the illegal toothfish trade. And now turning to biological diversity news. The EPA has flouted its own deadlines for analyzing toxic pesticides. The Environmental Protection Agency has missed its target dates for 2015 to assess risks posed by 3 highly controversial pesticides, atrazine, glyphosate, and imidacloprid. Atrazine and glyphosate are 2 of the most commonly used pesticides in the United States and are dangerous both to wildlife and people. Atrazine, an endocrine disruptor, is famous for chemically castrating frogs and is the likely cause of human birth defects, while glyphosate, the active ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup, is a leading cause of the decline of monarch butterflies and has been declared a probable human carcinogen. Imidacloprid, one of the world's most widely used insecticides, is a neonicotinoid heavily implicated in the mass die-off of bees and also highly toxic to birds and aquatic invertebrates, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Lorianne Bird. The EPA is dragging its feet in analyzing and telling the public about the full dangers of these pesticides, and the longer we're left in the dark, the greater the danger becomes. And a petition has been filed to extend monitoring for northern Rockies wolves. Following a study on the dangers of hunting policies enacted since protection for northern Rockies wolves have been lifted, the center and four partners petitioned to extend monitoring of these wolves' status to help keep them alive. Since 2009, when protections were first removed, more than 2,300 wolves have been killed by hunters and trappers in Montana and Idaho, both states having repeatedly increased hunting and trapping quotas and lengthened their season in an effort to substantially reduce wolf populations. New research published in the journal Science found that the Fish and Wildlife Service and the two states have underestimated the impacts and the risks of these increasingly aggressive wolf hunting guidelines, which are almost certainly resulting in population declines. The feds are required to extend the time that the service monitors the wolf population in such a situation, but they haven't agreed to do so yet. The new research confirms what many scientists have been saying all along. The center attorney, Andre Santarcier, left unchecked, wolf numbers will continue to decline. The Fish and Wildlife Service clearly needs to continue keeping an eye on them. And in a win for Canada lynx, Idaho must take actions on trapping. In a decision that will save lynx from cruel trapping deaths, federal district court found that a great snow cats living in the Panhandle and Clearwater regions of Idaho are in danger of incidental trapping, so restrictions on trapping in those areas are needed. Lynx are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, and the court found that trapping in northern Idaho is likely illegally harming them. In 2014, the Center for Biological Diversity and its allies sued Idaho for allowing trapping in lynx habitat. The court directed Idaho to alter its regulations to prevent future lynx deaths. It ordered the state to submit a plan to the court with terms that will truly protect lynx in the northern part of the state. "We're relieved that the court has ordered Idaho to do more to protect lynx," said the center's Andrea Santis-Darcer. Four lynx have been incidentally trapped in Idaho in the past 4 years, and the court agreed with us that the state cannot stand idly by and watch while indiscriminate traps harm these rare and federally protected cats. And the California Department of Fish and Wildlife has verified that a new wolf has crossed the state's northern border. The presence of a 3-year-old male wolf called OR-25 follows the discovery last August of the Shasta pack, the first known wolf family in California soil since gray wolves were eradicated here in the 1920s. OR-25 hails from Oregon's Imnaha pack, which also produced his predecessor in California, OR-7, who crossed over in 2011. The breeding female of the Shasta pack is also related to the Imnaha pack. In 2012, the center petitioned to protect the wolves under California's Endangered Species Act. That same year, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife started a group to make a wolf management plan, which has been released in draft form, and in 2014, wolves were granted state protection. "California is clearly wolf country because they keep coming here from Oregon," said the Center for Biological Diversity's Amarok Weiss. "That makes it all the more necessary to ensure that they have protections. It's also a reason to celebrate." And the Supreme Court has validated habitat protection for a rare California fish. "We are celebrating the news that the U.S. Supreme Court let stand the protection of 9,300 acres of critical habitat for Southern California's Santa Ana sucker, a small native fish that has vanished from nearly 95% of its historic range by the 1970s. 12 water districts and cities filed lawsuits in 2011 challenging the 2010 designation that protected sucker habitats in the San Bernardino, Riverside, Orange, and L.A. counties. The center and allies intervened on the case on behalf of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to assist in the defense of the agency's habitat designation. The Supreme Court has refused to review the case, upholding the lower court's ruling that the habitat protection could stand. The Center for Biological Diversity has worked for more than a decade to save this small olive gray fish. "It is a big win for the Santa Ana sucker," said the center's John Bues. "These protections will help make sure this tiny fish has a future, and they'll also protect many other kinds of wildlife that depend on these rivers for their survival." And in a win for climate, President Obama has paused federal coal leases. In a step forward in the growing movement to keep fossil fuels in the ground, the Obama administration announced plans to halt new coal leases on U.S. public lands as it reexamines the nationwide leasing program for coal. The move will provide a temporary reprieve from coal pollution that comes from federal lands. The coal program review will also include reexamining the rock bottom fees paid by companies to the federal government for extracting coal. Coal has been a massive culprit in the climate crisis, so this big news that the United States may finally be pulling back, said the center's Randy Spivak. But it can't end here. We need a permanent ban on new coal leases on public lands and the same for oil and gas. A study commissioned by the Center of Biological Diversity and Friends of the Earth found that banning new fossil fuel leases on public lands and oceans would keep up to 450 billion tons of carbon pollution from reaching the atmosphere, the pollution equivalent to about 118,000 coal-fired power plants. And you can find more information on this and other stories at www.biologicaldiversity.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is prepared every Thursday evening and broadcast at 9 p.m. You can hear a rebroadcast on Free Radio Santa Cruz, www.freakradio.org, and 101.3 FM on Thursdays at 3 p.m. You can also listen to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, in Moscow, Idaho, on 90.3 FM, where the Earth First Update is broadcast at 3 p.m. on Wednesdays. You can also listen to WZBC Boston, Massachusetts on 90.3 FM on Truth and Justice Radio, broadcast from 6 to 8:10 a.m. on Sundays. You can also tune your internet browser to Grateful Dread Public Radio, internet radio station, gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org. And they broadcast the Earth First Update on Sundays at 2 a.m. You can also tune in to them on TuneIn.com and Spotify. You can find the Earth First Update to download or listen online at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4.4all.net. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download at radioforall.net. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 and www.freakradio.org. I want to thank you for listening and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.